You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our third of four podcasts on the management of Alzheimer's disease hosted by Med Learning Group. Our overarching goal is to support primary care physicians, neurologists, psychiatrists, geriatricians, and other multidisciplinary team members who care for patients with Alzheimer's. This podcast is focused on timely screening and diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment in early Alzheimer's disease and the integration of disease-modifying treatments in clinical practice. My name is Surabhi Dangi-Garimella, and I'll be your host for today's podcast. In our prior episodes, we heard the primary care and neurology perspectives on screening, diagnosing, and managing MCI due to early AD. In this episode, we will gain insight into the important role played by geriatrics in differential diagnosis and integrating DMTs with the patient-caregiver goals of care in mind. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce and welcome our program chair, Dr. George Grossberg, and our guest expert, Dr. Angela Sanford.
Thank you very much. It's great to have Dr. Angela Sanford, who's kind of a rising star, I've said, and a leader in the field of geriatric medicine with us. So thank you, Angela, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to start with a case from my clinic, and I want to kind of share this with you and our, as well as our listening audience. The case is of Mr. McMillan, who's a 72-year-old high school principal, came to our memory clinic accompanied by his wife and adult daughter. The family had noticed changes in recent memory over the past 6 to 12 months. For example, he was misplacing things, and because of that, he was often getting kind of very frustrated. They also had concerns because he was needing more assistance or more help in balancing the checkbook and making wise investment decisions, which previously were not a problem. They also cited that recently he had gone to the supermarket. I think his wife had asked him to pick up a few things, and he forgot to get the things that she wanted him to buy. His daughter also noticed that when they had family gatherings and had all the grandchildren there, sometimes he would mix up the names of the grandkids. But very importantly, they said, all of them said that there were no problems at work, and he has a responsible job, and he was independent in all of his basic activities of daily living. He did have a family history on his dad's side of senile dementia, which started in his father with his father when he was in his 70s. Medical history, I think, Angela, as you see all the time, very typical for someone his age. He had well-controlled hypertension, hyperlipidemia, osteoarthritis, acid reflux, and allergic rhinitis. His medication list, again, you know, fairly common. He was on lisinopril hydrochlorothiazide for his blood pressure. He was on a statin. He was taking extra strength acetaminophen for pain. He was on famotidine for his reflux, cetirizine for allergies, and then a couple of supplements, vitamin D3 and a B-complex multivitamin. There was no history of alcohol or substance use, no cannabis use, for example. And on mental status, he was alert, spoke clearly, his speech was goal-directed. He did at times, when we asked certain questions, look to his wife because he wasn't always sure about the answers that he was giving, although the answers were very appropriate. There was no evidence of depression, no serious anxiety, he was not psychotic, nothing focal either on exam or neuro exam, or his blood pressure was fine. We did the St. Louis University mental status, which is similar to the MoCA and the mini mental. He scored a 25 out of 30. His PHQ-9 was a 2, so as I mentioned, there was no evidence of depression. And he scored 100% on his Barthel activities of daily living inventory. He had not had recent blood work, so we did some general and specialized blood tests, a complete metabolic profile, a CBC, a TSH, B12, folate, homocysteine, C-reactive protein. They were all within normal limits. We did a brain MRI without contrast, and again, it was fairly unremarkable. He did have some subcortical small vessel disease, which is a very nonspecific, very common finding in our older adults. So we could maybe start by having you just kind of think about this case, because it is fairly typical. And, you know, what are the kinds of things that you might be thinking about as kind of either next steps, or what might you be advising, you know, Mr. McMillan and or his family at this stage of things?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Grossberg. In general, when we see patients like this, I have a kind of running list in my head of things to go through. And with Mr. McMillan, I would first start with his medications. And when I'm looking at his medication list, I don't really see any medications that I think might be contributing to his memory loss. But we often, in the older adult population, find that people are on medications that can affect their cognition. So it's a good place to start.
So what are the specific or the classes or groups of meds that you most often find in older adults that can, in fact, contribute to cognitive impairment? What are the things you're looking for?
The big one is the medication class of the anticholinergics. So bladder medications, Benadryl is a big one. I find that people take Benadryl at nighttime to help with sleep. People are on sleep aids over the counter or prescribed that also may contribute to kind of the daytime fogginess that some people experience. Those are the big drug classes.
What else are you looking for?
We're looking for reversible causes. That first visit, I spend looking for reversible causes. So the medications, I'm also looking for mood disorders. It does say he was not depressed, but this is a common finding. We find concurrent depression with memory loss. We call it pseudo-dementia. And so I always do a good depression screening at that first visit. And then another reversible cause that's pretty typical is obstructive sleep apnea. So I always ask questions, you know, how are you sleeping at night? Do you snore at night? You know, and asking his partner, you know, does he sleep through the night? Do you notice that he has any trouble with breathing or stopping breathing overnight? Because that's a very treatable cause of memory impairment.
Yeah, that's really important. I'm glad you brought that up, because we also find in our clinic that we do ask detailed questions about sleep. And often in the primary care setting, those questions aren't asked. And a variety of sleep disorders, and in particular, obstructive sleep apnea, are not recognized, not diagnosed, and not treated. But I think in the geriatrician setting, you guys are very good about asking those kinds of detailed questions. So you kind of beat us to the punch. Now, one of our foci for this podcast is the notion of kind of early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, either mild at the stage of mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease, or very early Alzheimer's dementia. And my thinking is that we seem to be seeing more people, and I wonder how you feel about it and what you're seeing, more people that fit this picture. Are you also seeing more people that kind of come early? And if you are, you know, how do you handle all these folks? What do you do to manage everyone?
So I will say, as a geriatrician, I only see people over 65, and I tend to see my clinic population, probably the median age is really 80, or the average age is 80, 75 to 80. So I am finding that I get referred cases later. You know, I get referred the dementia cases. I'm not getting many of the mild cognitive impairment, at least not the family coming and saying there's something wrong with, you know, my loved one's memory, or the loved one saying that. I pick it up in just my routine screening, but I don't tend to have people referred to me for that reason. It's usually in the later stages that I get those referrals.
But in the cases, as far as where you might be concerned, as far as kind of initial identification of either mild cognitive impairment or early Alzheimer's dementia, are there, for geriatricians, are there guidelines for screening in the kind of geriatric setting? And are there resources that one can utilize in that scenario?
Sure. In geriatric clinic, we screen everyone. That is not typical across medical practices. Unfortunately, most of the major, you know, medical organizations don't at this time recommend screening because of insufficient evidence, but we believe it's best practice. In the population we see, the prevalence is so much higher that we do routine screening on everyone.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea. So everyone that comes to your clinic is screened. What do you guys use as far as screening tools? I mentioned the three tools that are standard in our clinic, which were the St. Louis University Mental Status for cognition, the PHQ-9 for mood, and then the Barthel inventory relative to ADLs.
We use the SLUMS examination. I use that on the first visit. I'd like a, you know, it's the full version. On subsequent visits, just For a quick screening, we do the rapid cognitive screen. It's the shorter version of the SLUMS test. And that helps me just make sure that there haven't been major changes in between visits. And then I also do a geriatric depression scale for the depression screening, and then an Epworth sleep scale for the obstructive sleep apnea.
Do you do that on everyone or only if you suspect sleep apnea?
I do it on everyone the first visit. It's called a comprehensive geriatric assessment. So in addition to those three, the SLUMS, the GDS, the obstructive sleep apnea, Epworth screen, I also do an ADL and IADL screen as well.
I think all of us are very impressed, and you guys have been accused of being thorough. That's a good thing to be accused of. I think that's very impressive. There's no doubt about that. Now, you already talked earlier about things that you're considering as far as the differential diagnosis. So you mentioned, for example, depression, which can present with a dementia-type syndrome, and that's very important to consider. You mentioned what I call bad drugs, or drugs that are bad for the brain, whether it's anticholinergics or benzodiazepines or narcotic analgesics, just a whole list of those, the Beers list kind of stuff. One of the conditions you didn't mention was delirium. I'm wondering how often you see that and its many causes looking like, let's say, either mild cognitive impairment or early Alzheimer's disease.
I don't tend to see that in the clinic setting. That would be more of something we'll pick up in the hospital or sometimes the nursing home. But in the clinic setting, it's not as common, you know, to have ongoing delirium, I would say, in a patient living in the community.
That's a good point. And of course, you do a lot of long-term care work, as do many geriatricians. And you may even do, I don't know if you do consults in the acute patient units, but that's another part of your portfolio. So what do you use to diagnose delirium? Anything in particular?
Yeah, we use something called the CAM score. It's a scale that actually was developed in ICU patients because delirium frequently occurs in those in the ICU. So we use that to diagnose delirium.
So you guys do a very thorough evaluation, but I'm sure that there may be instances when you're evaluating someone with potential MCI due to Alzheimer's disease or maybe possibly early Alzheimer's dementia, where after you do your thorough assessment, you might refer to one or more specialists. So what are those situations where you might do that?
That's a good question. The most common specialist I tend to refer to is the neuropsychologist. And I don't refer every patient to the neuropsychologist, but if their test scores are incongruent with the story or the history I'm hearing. For instance, there are several occupations where people tend to score higher on the screening test. So people that were doctors, lawyers, teachers tend to do better on the screening test, and it doesn't always match what their family is saying their symptoms are. So in that case, I will refer for a more comprehensive neuropsych evaluation with testing. And in that testing, it's usually a four-hour test, and they test all the cognitive domains and can usually really hone in on where the deficits are.
I think that's a reasonable referral. And we use neuropsychology also very, very regularly. And we're very blessed to have five neuropsychologists in my department who do nothing but testing. But in many parts of the country, neuropsychology is just not available. And sometimes we might refer to a variety of specialists. Of course, they're all busy. There's waiting lists. How do you manage that as far as working together with others? And what other specialists might you refer to?
A neurologist would be another one to refer to. They, you know, deal with diseases of the brain and can assist in managing and diagnosing dementia.
But again, the barrier being mostly wait lists. So at least in most metropolitan areas, it may take months as a new patient to get a neurology consult.
And in rural areas, there often aren't any availability of these specialists either.
Yeah, that's a problem. Now, as a geriatrician, I kind of see you, if I would have one of your patients, I see you as kind of the leader of the team. But unfortunately, when I work with many primary care physicians, they don't necessarily view their role that way. So when they send patients to us, often, you know, though they may still have contact with the patient, they rarely, if ever, take that role. So how do you kind of manage or how do you orchestrate being the captain of the team with a variety of not only specialist physicians, but It could be rehab people, could be social work and other components of the healthcare team.
Communication is very important. I think communication with the family can often help you tie together all these visits and let you know what other specialists that their loved one is seeing, especially if they're outside of your healthcare system. But in regards to the primary care doctors, I think many primary care physicians aren't trained in how to do the workup of dementia. And their visits are so short, 15 minutes often for a primary care visit, you know, they can't manage the medical problems and the cognitive issues in the same visit. And I think it becomes very difficult. In geriatrics, we have a 30-minute appointment, so we have a little bit more time to really be more comprehensive with that.
That'd be 30 minutes for follow-up visits. And then
for a follow-up.
And for new patients, how much time do you all spend?
60 minutes.
Okay, so a full hour. In the real world, it's usually a lot less than that for both, especially for the follow-up visits. They could be 12 minutes or something akin to that. Yeah, so that's a good thing. Now, if we focus more specifically on someone like Mr. McMillan, someone who looks to have maybe mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease or very early Alzheimer's dementia, again, you might, as you mentioned, refer them to neuropsychology for more detailed testing to further kind of confirmation. But it would not be unusual, and again, you're the geriatrician, it would not be unusual for either that patient, because they're pretty intact, and or the family to be asking about what are the treatment options available for me or for my dad or my husband, you know, in this case. So how do you handle that, and what do geriatricians usually do at that juncture?
So we have two classes of medications we can use. We have the disease-modifying drugs and then symptom management drugs. And the symptom management drugs really aren't approved for mild cognitive impairment, but the disease-modifying agents that are newer on the market are available and are approved for the mild cognitive impairment range. So these are an option. This is an option to discuss the risk and the benefits and see what the patient's interest level is in undergoing one of these therapies.
So if, let's say, and I had a, again, this Mr. McMillan, highly educated individual, family also reads quite a bit. They were already asking about the monoclonal antibodies and the disease-modifying therapies. So kind of what do you do, I mean, specifically when patients and or families inquire about the disease-modifying therapies? How do you handle that?
We actually have a special clinic, actually. Dr. Grossberg and his group run our disease-modifying agent clinic. And so I would make the referral to them. They are the ones that would start the therapy. I think also it's important to note that about 30% of those with mild cognitive impairment go on to progress to the dementia stage each year, but 70% remain in the mild cognitive impairment range. So sometimes after that first visit, I want to have another visit just to check the trajectory of this and kind of see if the memory loss progresses.
And then you mentioned also the symptomatic therapies, which are obviously not precluded by having someone also who's interested in maybe even being on a monoclonal. Now, in outside of the academic setting, where, as you mentioned, we maybe have resources to refer someone for monoclonal therapy to a different department or a different division, what do the geriatricians do in the real world, out in the private sector? What is your sense there?
I am not sure of how many private entities are administering, you know, the disease-modifying agents. I would think that the majority of them are occurring at academic centers in memory clinics and such.
So your sense is that geriatricians are, well, they're doing pretty much what we heard from the primary care field. So in primary care, they also maybe have a comfort level, a growing comfort level in diagnosing MCI and maybe very early AD, but they don't yet have the resources or the comfort level in treating and monitoring for safety and all the things that are involved in prescribing and monitoring a monoclonal antibody. So you'd say it's similar in geriatric medicine?
Yes, that's correct. And we have to keep in mind that you pretty much have to have a team. You need to have an infusion center that's able to do the infusions for these medications. You need to have really good radiologists because there's frequent MRIs just to check progress in the brain. So it's a really comprehensive program, and not everyone would have access to that, especially in rural areas.
Yeah. So just back to this Mr. McMillan. So he and his family, you know, did ask about monoclonal antibodies, which we do have available, and we have a special kind of entry pathway for those in my department or my division. But when patients and families ask you about the pros and the cons of the monoclonals, how do you approach that as a geriatrician?
I am still, it's still such a new medication, and I'm still reading the literature about sort of what this looks like over time, because we're really still in the first infancy stages of doing these medications. So it's hard to know what the long-term progression of, you know, the mild cognitive impairment or early onset or early disease, Alzheimer's disease, will look like with these medications. What I've seen in just in practice so far is that patients who are on this therapy tend to remain relatively stable, so that their memory doesn't change as quickly as it may have off of the, you know, not getting medication.
I think that makes a lot of sense. So one of my take-home messages, which is really, really important from all the good things that you mentioned today, was that mild cognitive impairment does not invariably convert to dementia, or this MCI due to what we think is Alzheimer's disease, convert to Alzheimer's dementia. But of course, the notion of waiting is always relative, because we do have evidence that the monoclonals seem to make the most difference the earlier you intervene. So we don't want to wait till people they're not even eligible in the middle and later stages. So it's kind of a balancing act in that regard. A lot of good advice, a lot of great information. Any bottom line take-home messages for our listening audience?
Oh, that's a tough one.
No, I stole your bottom line. That's why it's tough. I think what I appreciate the conversation, but what I really learned today was particularly being aware of the natural history of mild cognitive impairment. And I think at one time, I think you know this, not that long ago, we used to think that if you wait long enough, everybody converts from MCI to dementia, usually Alzheimer's disease. But we now know that that may not be true. So we have to kind of take all of that into consideration as well. So we've run out of time way too quick. I could spend a lot more time with you, but thank you for joining us, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Dr. Grossberg and Dr. Sanford, for this highly insightful discussion. And thank you to all of you for joining. Do tune in to the last episode, where we will be joined by an expert geriatric psychiatrist. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group, who, in support of improving patient care, is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And thank you to Lilly for providing an educational grant for this activity.